Welcome to the Journal of African History podcast. We do this usually to go along with the release of our issues. We have today two authors of an article that appears in the current issue of the journal. Their article is titled Abolition and the Registration of Slaves and Libertos in Portuguese Mozambique, 1856 to 1876, introducing Professor Edward Alpas, who is a research professor at the University of California in Los Angeles, and Daniel Dominguez, assistant professor at Rice University. Welcome to this podcast.
Hi, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
I have a set of questions here regarding your article that I'm going to just go right ahead and ask. And this will be a conversation about the article, the process that led to it, the arguments, the contributions, and so on and so forth. So let me get right to it. I'm curious. This interesting article appears in the current edition of the journal. How did you come about this? The topic of the research? Is this paper an offshoot of your respective research projects, or is it a wholly new project that the two of you are embarking upon?
Why don't I start and Daniel can pick it up, because we come at it differently. So in my case, I was working. We met at a conference in Maputo in October 2017 on the slave trade, slavery and the slave trade. So we were both giving papers about completely different aspects of abolition and liberated slaves. I was working with a single document, a register of libertos from Cabo Delgado, one of the provinces in Mozambique. And it was really a byproduct of other work that I'd been doing on 19th century Mozambique history for a long time. And at the end of that paper, I said, I know that there are other registries, but there's so much data in them, I'm not trained to handle them. So I'd love to see some graduate students from Mozambique or somebody who's trained as a digital historian who might be interested in working with me, and we can, you know, we'll see where it goes. And Daniel stepped up and said, after our panel, he came up, I knew something about his work on Angola and the South Atlantic, but we'd never met before.
Yes, I volunteered to help because I was somewhat familiar with the documents, having worked on their counterparts produced in Angola, right? So I was familiar with the history of the process of registration and abolition of slavery in the Portuguese colonies in Africa. And I had used that documentation in my book, The Atlantic Slave Trade from West Central Africa. So I thought I could make a contribution. I also had experience working with similar registers made by the British for the liberation of Africans who were transported across the Atlantic in violation of international treaties. And this research was associated with the Slave Voyages Transatlantic Slave Trade Database Project. So I thought I could now help NAD, and it would also give me an opportunity to start a second book project focused on an area different than Angola, in this particular case, Mozambique.
That's an interesting story about collaboration in research and writing, one that maybe we can return to later on. But I wanted to ask the two of you what the central arguments and historiographical contributions of this article are. You know, what gaps does this article fill? And, you know, what's the big takeaway for historians, you know, working in or even outside, you know, the field of slavery, abolition, and the Atlantic world, broadly articulated?
Daniel, why don't you, when we talked about this last night, why don't you...
Sure. I'll be happy to answer this question. So I think it fills an important gap in the historiography of Africa and of Mozambique. In particular, the period between the suppression of the transatlantic slave trade and colonialism is not as well studied as you know, the period immediately after, that is, you know, imperialism, conquest, the scramble, and the formal era of European colonialism in Africa, and you know, the preceding era of the transatlantic slave trade, right? So I think it, you know, helps bridge that gap. Interestingly, when we presented a version of this paper at the African Studies Association meeting, David Morton also made the interesting comment that, you know, thanks to the work of Alan Isaacman, Barbara Isaacman, Benigma Simba, and Eric Alina, I mean, we know a lot about, you know, slavery and forced labor in Mozambique, you know, from the late 19th century. So by looking at the process of abolition and registration in Mozambique in the second half of the 19th century, we kind of offer the background story, right, to the processes that unfolded from the late 19th century, right? And we make the argument that Portuguese government first attempted to centralize power in Mozambique by or using the process of abolition, yeah, which is known to remove the local elite access known to slave labor, so that weakened local elites and transfer power to the central authorities now being represented in the province by the governors appointed from Lisbon.
Interesting. Ned, do you want to add anything to that answer?
Well, I was just thinking that that something, not only is there a rich body of work on the 20th century, but there's quite a bit on the slave trade up to about the middle of the 19th century. So my earliest work, Pedro Machado's work, and others, and this is a big gap. And in fact, in terms of this transition, although our paper and the body of work or of documentation we're working with is primarily in the third quarter of the 19th century, there is some material that we picked up and that's included in the article that shows how, with the abolition of, and before the really the conquest, especially the conquest of Mozambique, which is a military conquest that occurs from the late 19th century, really into the first, depending on where you are in the country, into the first two decades of the 20th century, that there are these steps that kind of feed into with the better known history of plans for forced labor and things like that. And this is where the gap is. So there's some material we have at the very end of the article that points to that as well. So the other thing that's really interesting is that it fits into on the sources themselves. The material we're working with is, depending on its completeness, quite rich in terms of the possibilities for social history. So it's more than just a numerical counting for how many slaves or how many libertus there were. And that's what actually first attracted me to this one register, the fact that there is a lot of social material embedded in these. And this is a very much a parallel to what you get for registers of liberated slaves in the Atlantic world, too. There's an enormous amount of material there beyond counting, which has, of course, dominated so much of the study of the slave trade and slavery.
That's great. I mean, it seems to me that this article is looking at a very interesting period of transition where multiple events and phenomena come together. You know, you have abolition going on there, you have forced labor, and then you have this colonial consolidation. So it seems to me that, you know, because you are looking at these complex processes together in one analytic frame, it presents problems of sources and methodology and so on and so forth. So I wanted to ask you, I don't want to just see if you could tell us a little bit about the sources that you deploy in this article. As you know, there are several databases on enslaved and Africans and even liberated slaves in the Atlantic world broadly. So this archive, this material that you work on, how is it different from the other existing databases on enslaved Africans and on liberated slaves? That's a loaded question, but yeah.
Yes, no, but it's important to highlight the differences because they are different, right? So the database that we created are based on registers made by Portuguese colonial officials in Mozambique, not just on the coastal sites of Mozambique, but also in the interior of Mozambique, right? And they were intended, to kind of, provide a snapshot of the slave population with the purpose of, abolishing slavery gradually in Mozambique, right? So there were two sets of registers made, one for the population already enslaved in Portuguese territories, and the second one, which is called the Registers of Libertos, meaning freedmen, right, which were dedicated to register people who had been forced into Portuguese territories by land and who were supposed to get their full freedom 10 years after they were registered, right? So those people, they were never put on slave ships, right? Like, for example, the leases of liberated Africans produced by the British in Freetown, in Havana, in Rio de Janeiro, and other sites of the Atlantic world, right? So they are very different. And they form the main component of our article. But we were very surprised when we went to Maputo and then later to Lisbon to find that there were significant correspondence between not just the provincial governor and the colonial office in Lisbon, but also between governors in each of the Portuguese districts within Mozambique and the provincial governor. And we could even find sometimes documents between local authorities within a particular district. And that was a wealth of provides a wealth of information that we thought wasn't available before, right? And we were happily surprised to locate them. And it's a significant amount. So it's also challenging to keep track of them.
And I have to say, I'm eternally grateful to Daniel and Daniel's training because the database that he's created makes it possible or more possible to track this material. One of the things I recognized when I was first working on the one document, which has over 3,000 names in it, is that I just didn't have the training to know how, I would have to completely retool myself, which is why I needed to work with somebody who could do this. It's important to emphasize, Daniel's mentioned it, but to emphasize that this is not, you can count the registered, these were not people who were sent for export. There's a whole different body of material that goes back to the kind of work I've done and that José Capella and others did in counting the numbers of Africans who were shipped, whether to Madagascar or the Comoros or to the Mascarene Islands or to Brazil. That's a different element. There is an interesting connection in that there was a prohibition against trading, exporting slave labor once you were a liberto. And of course, some people tried to. So one of the interesting, some of the documentation actually talks about stopping that from happening. But it's really, it's the contrast between slavery and the slave trade actually on the continent of Africa and also worth pointing out something the first readers and the editors were concerned about. We had said Mozambique and they said, which Mozambique? So that's why we say Portuguese Mozambique, because it's not the Mozambique that we know today. It's these specific points on the coast and up the Zambezi River where there was a Portuguese presence. And that's why it's very specific that way. So there is a wealth of material. So one of the other kinds of things that complements what Daniel was saying is in some cases there are petitions or references to petitions by slave owners not wanting this to happen or saying, well, we'll only do this if you do this for us. So there's a great deal of material that is really incredibly rich, quite frankly, And of course, variable, both in terms of the numbers of slaves involved and the distance from Mozambique. But it gives you a real sense of what the Portuguese on the ground were dealing with, and then how that fit or did not fit, if you like, with what the metropolitan authorities wanted to happen. Because, of course, they're playing out their own politics of abolition in a kind of a liberal regime in Lisbon as well.
Well, that's great. I mean, it seems to me that the complexity of this story in this article inheres in the fact that you are dealing with multiple actors in the colony, in the metropole. You're dealing with liberated slaves, the libertos. You're dealing with multiple interests, you know, that are intersecting, that are in tension with one another, and that these actors are producing narratives of different kinds and making all kinds of claims. Then, I mean, you know, that of course leaves a huge archive, a huge archival footprint that you now have to navigate. So along those lines, I wanted to, you know, when you have a huge archive of that nature, of course, it throws up all kinds of questions and issues and difficulties for the researcher. So I wanted to ask you what methodological challenges you encountered in the course of researching this article, and how did you overcome these challenges?
Yeah, the overwhelming amount of documents that we found, and no, keeping them organized, and that was certainly a challenge. At the same time, you know, we have to step back a little bit and look at exactly what survived, right? And even though we have identified several sources, you know, very helpful sources, by trying to reconstruct what might have been the actual size of the archive and the documentation produced, we realized that, you know, it is, you know, only a fraction, right, of what was once produced about this important historical event. So one challenge was known to, you know, create this idea, this consciousness, right, that what we were doing was, you know, dealing with, although numerous, right, in size or significant in size, was just a part of it. And try to, you know, as we reconstruct the numbers of people register and how the process unfolded, you know, to make that clear to the readers, and at the same time keep track of the sources that we located.
It's important to recognize, I think all historians of Africa who work with this kind of material would know this, but it's important to recognize that this is all produced within the context of Portuguese colonialism. So there's very little self-reflection, for example, in any of this documentation. And I'm hoping maybe at some point some young Portuguese scholar will discover, let's say, the papers of one of these governors somewhere, you know, that's been tucked away, that would show somebody thinking about things of this sort. And of course, that would still only be, wouldn't be the African side. But it means that in all of this, when you're trying to figure out what was actually happening on the ground, you're always reading against the fact that these are official documents that are being produced with a specific audience in mind and in response to specific questions. One of the things that Daniel has been very observant about and really has made a terrific use of is that the Portuguese, they were highly bureaucratic. And even though the documentation itself is not complete, in these registries of letters, you very often don't have the letters, but in these summaries, they'll refer to other documents. They'll say, in the letter that you sent to me on such and such a date and so and so, and then going beyond the registries to the larger documentation, you can often find references to that. So that's it's a very complicated process, but in some ways helped by the Portuguese attention to detail in this. The other thing that's worth saying that we haven't mentioned is that there were a number of points, Cabo Delgado, Mozambique, Kalamani in the mouth of the Zambezi River, Sena and Tete, Zumbo even, and then Sofala and Inhambane and Bazaruto and Lourenço Marques. So that these different points on the map that the that they were doing these registries from, but they're not all complete. Some of them aren't complete at all, and so that it's not putting the database together and the numbers however problematic that may be, doesn't mean that you have parallel information for each registry. There are some registries that are quite complete, but they're smaller. So it gives you a sense of what might have been there. And so we'll have to, as we work through a larger project on this, we'll be clearly paying attention to teasing out as much of that material as we can get. But it's episodic. It depends on where you're, you know, which registry you're looking at as to how much information you can actually pull out of it. And I'll say one other thing that's really interesting on this. What we know is because the names of the slave owners, the senhoras, the masters, we have those. We have full Portuguese names. We have Indians. We have some local Swahili in certain cases who were slave owners who registered. And it would be possible, even, and it is possible in some cases, even in the official documentation, to follow those, to, in a sense, to do a social history of those people by following them through a longer period of time. It would be a massive project. Of course, it's much harder, if not impossible, to do that for the Africans, for whom only first names are given. And depending on the completeness, there may be ethnicity, age, gender, even what they did. But to find individuals is much harder to do because of the way in which the Portuguese recorded the information.
What is fascinating about this article, at least from my standpoint, is the status or rather the category of the liberators. You know, it seems it's something that is so central to this piece. And for non-specialists like myself, I just find it quite fascinating because it seems like an ambiguous status or position to occupy in this particular time period in this very interesting Atlantic African space. So if you could, you know, it's a Portuguese term. Could you, you know, just get into it a little bit and help us understand what that category meant and what that status really entailed in the mid to late 19th century Mozambique? And could you also tell us why this category was highly contested, was such a charged status, and why it was heavily contested by all the actors involved in this story?
It was highly contested because from the perspective of Portuguese legislators and statesmen, it was confusing, right? And it also created a kind of a opportunity for people who were enslaved to leave that status, right, of being enslaved, right, to improve their lot, their situation, to escape slavery, so to speak, right? Liberto, just in Portuguese, literally means freed, right, or liberated. I prefer freed. You know, I think it's more closely related. But it was ambiguous because, you know, those are people who had been enslaved. They were brought to Portuguese territories as slaves. But they arrived at a moment after the Portuguese said, well, you know, from this point on, we're not accepting any more slaves in our colonies. We had abolished the slave trade in 1836, you know, by law. And we're now working to abolish slavery altogether, but we're going to do it through a gradual form, right? We're going to deliver a natural death to slavery in our colonies. So we're going to freeze the slave population, the status. You know, those who are slaves will remain slaves, but anyone now brought into our territories, you know, we're going to categorize them as libertos, as freed people, meaning that they are going to be here. They're going to be put into the care of private individuals. There will be a court who will also be watching over them, and they should receive their full freedom 10 years from now, right? 10 years from the moment that they are registered. And that creates a problem because the people who had already been enslaved, right? They don't want to be slaves themselves, right? They want to be freed. They want to have the same status as the libertos. For the master class, it is already there announcing that slavery at one point will end, right? And of course, they don't want that to happen, right? So it anticipates the whole idea of a society without slavery. And then also introduces the question about, okay, if we're going to have a society without slaves, what will be the status, right? What will be the political status and role of these individuals? See, we have to think that this is happening also in the context of the liberal revolutions, right, in Europe at the time. And people were thinking about notions of, you know, citizenship, political participation, right? So this is also being introduced in Africa. And Africans, you know, including those who are enslaved, are, you know, taking notice of that and also trying to shape a position, a role for themselves.
One of the fascinating aspects of this too is by studying this process, it reminds you of how limited Portuguese control really was, even at Mozambique. I mean, on the island, obviously, that they had total control. But on the mainland, they're surrounded by sometimes friendly, sometimes hostile Swahili and Makua chiefdoms, small states. And of course, this is exactly where, from the very end of the 19th century into the 20th century, the Portuguese had to wage war to defeat these people. And the same thing if you go to Cabo Delgado, or if you go down to Sofala and Inhambane, where you have the Gaza and Guni kingdom, that around the area that the Portuguese were trying to control, people clearly could flee, but probably into another form of bondage. And in the case of northern Mozambique, there was still considerable slave trade going on from local rulers. So I think one of the things one has to be careful about is not to think that we're talking about a carefully controlled colonial state. It's not a state yet. It's a bunch of little points that the Portuguese are trying to do. And one of the things that I think in longer term that we're both interested in is to see if we can, find any evidence of what happens on the edges immediately outside this process. And that's, of course, been, it's a little bit like how to, in an earlier period with the ivory trade or the slave trade or any other, how did it actually operate? You only at the coast only get the end result. You can see what's being exported, sometimes what the price is, but very little, you know, we know much less about how things actually occurred in the interior. And so there's that interesting dynamic there too.
I mean, this is a very fascinating story of, you know, for me, it's because you have, it seems to me that this is a uniquely sort of Indian Ocean set of processes of enslavement and abolition and colonization in its informal stages. And so it makes for a very highly contested political terrain. And so that's interesting. And at the same time, I think it's connected to the Atlantic processes as well. It's been influenced by the Atlantic processes, even though, so it raises questions of sovereignty, colonization and territoriality and so on and so forth. Quite fascinating. I wanted to end this conversation with something not directly related to the paper, but you know, in our field, most articles and most works of this nature are usually researched and written by individuals, single or scholars. Why did you decide to do this piece together? What would you say are the, you know, rewards and challenges of, you know, working together on an article, you know?
Well, I can start by saying, as I said before, from my point of view, I couldn't have written this without Daniel, because he's the one who built the database. I mean, technically, digital history is a serious enterprise, and he was trained to do that. My training is you know, completely different when you consider, you know, when I did my PhD at SOAS. We're now looking at more than 50 years ago. And I've learned a lot of tricks since then, but none of them quite so technically done. So in terms of writing, I've actually done some things like this before. It's quite interesting. In this specific case, and Daniel will correct me if I'm wrong, we had two different pieces. I had a certain body of material from the paper I gave in Mozambique. he had drafted, we'd actually talked already at this point about doing a larger project, which we're going to continue to work on, you know, with this material. So he had actually drafted kind of the metropolitan part of a chapter. And that became the basis for the first part of the article. And then we just, you know, it's interesting trying to untangle and also trying to remember how you do this. But once we got something down on paper, then we both worked as editors of our own work and back and forth. It's an interesting process, and it's clearly one that, speaking for myself, I could not have done by myself. As opposed to, let's say, I've got an article coming out, a chapter coming out in a book that's about to appear, this on the cattle trade from Madagascar and the Comoro Islands to Mozambique on it in the 19th century. And I've got a nice little database of about 100 some ships bringing cattle over and everything. And, you know, I can manage that. And that's something I didn't need any help with. But the massiveness of this data set imposes itself. It's such a project. And I think in the future, my own particular interest in the writing is in trying to tease out bits and pieces of social history, political history, things that are there. And this Daniel's obviously interested in that too, but that if there's a specific division of labor, because that's where my part comes in. But writing together is an interesting process. You have to, which word do you pick? How do you phrase something? And that's just that's an interesting iteration that goes back and forth between the two of us until we think we've got something that we could send off.
I think the collaboration evolved organically through our meetings, correspondence, and presentations. For me, it was great working with Nat because, I mean, he's a much more established researcher. He is, you know, a specialist in the field of East African history, whereas I am kind of a newcomer to this area, right? So I benefit tremendously from that. Ned had also previously conducted research in Mozambique and Portugal. So he was familiar with the archives. That was very helpful. And another thing, I mean, like he mentioned, right, I do have this digital history background and experience. And that helps a lot when you are trying to marshal and analyze the huge amounts of data, right, sources and so on. But it's, you know, work like his on specific areas, sites, right, or dealing with, you know, specific peoples. Very important, right? Because now they throw light, they better throw light on the realities on the ground, right? On the experiences of the individuals going through that process of registration and abolition. And I think that's very valuable and complements my approach, which is more of a quantitative analysis, looking for patterns and so on. So I thought it was very beneficial, the collaboration.
I'd say one other thing. For me, it's enormous fun working on the details of these things, like this cattle trade paper, which is totally separate, because most of my work in the last 10 years has been at a very broad level of Indian Ocean history. So I'm reading and writing about things in Indonesia and South Asia and pulling all of this together from largely from other people's work and published primary stuff. So to be able to come back in the context of Mozambique or some stuff I've done in the Swahili coast recently and work at a much finer level of detail is really something that gives me great pleasure, so that I'm able to sort of, you know, do these two different things, wear these different hats as a scholar, and hope I can continue to do that.
Well, thank you so much, gentlemen and colleagues, treasured colleagues. My name is Moses Ochonu, and it's been a pleasure anchoring this conversation. I hope that we can do this some other time. Thank you for joining us on the Journal of African History podcast.